So we're going to do our reflection a little later in the service. Today, as some of you know, March 1st is the first day of Women's History Month. It started in 1987. And today, we find ourselves at a strange juncture in terms of gender. Women have made huge advances, but there are still some roles that seem closed to women. We've also learned that gender is much more complex than we previously understood it to be, and that many people are left out of a male-female binary. So as we seek to create space for more diverse expressions of gender, we are experiencing backlash from traditionalists. So at this moment, when we teeter between greater gender freedom and greater restriction, we still find it necessary to advocate for women's voices and women's rights, and to celebrate traditionally feminine qualities that any of us can embody. Women have made remarkable progress in recent decades. They now head elite universities, Fortune 500 companies. They occupy seats in the US Senate and Congress and on the Supreme Court. But they remain distinct minorities in most of those realms. Ruth Bader Ginsburg alluded to the persistence of the male norm when she said there would be enough women on the Supreme Court when there were 9 of them, noting that nobody ever questioned the long history, 200 plus years, of 9 men on that body. Women have made advances in religion as well and can be ordained in most Protestant denominations. I'm wearing my wild clergywoman pin today, which I picked up at a clergy women's conference once. One of the first women to be ordained in this country was the Universalist pastor Olympia Brown, who was ordained in 1863. But it wasn't until the 1970s that women began to ordain or to enter the ministry in large numbers in the UU Church. A study in 2017 found that women comprised 57% of UU clergy, making us one of the few religious organizations where clergy women outnumber clergymen. Our own congregation was a little late to the game. We welcomed Kate Walker as our first female pastor in 1998. However, all but one of our ministers since then have been women. In many spheres, then, women have come a long way. At the same time, we now recognize that not everyone identifies as male or female, and some people's gender identity, that sense of being masculine or feminine, does not match their biological sex. Transgender persons and those who are non-binary or gender fluid test our traditional understandings of gender itself. The evolving acronym for that community illustrates its complexity. What started as LGB for lesbian, gay, and bisexual has grown to LGBTQIA+, as we added T for transgender, Q for queer or questioning, I for intersex, A for asexual, and finally a plus sign, as even that string of letters was not inclusive of the range of sexual and gender identities that people experience. It's no wonder the queer community chose a rainbow as its symbol. My brother's adult child came out as non-binary several years ago, and I have to confess I still struggle to use they-them pronouns and to avoid masculine references to Chris, but I recognize my own discomfort with those changes, and it helps me to recognize the discomfort that queer people have long felt in a world built on a sexual and gender binary that they do not fit. A growing discomfort with changes in gender roles and with the range of gender expressions that we experience now have led to strong pushback and the reassertion of traditional gender roles and identities that make it necessary, yes, even in 2026, to still focus on women's contributions. Given the complexity of gender, though, I want to suggest that this month we don't just celebrate biological women, but we recognize qualities traditionally associated with women that anyone can embody regardless of how they identify. Now, this is clearly a stereotype. These are traits that many men also display and that not all women do. But their association with women is surprisingly consistent across cultures, probably related to motherly roles that women embrace. These include qualities like that foster connection, compassion, support, qualities that are in short supply these days and are seen by some as signs of weakness or submission. Cultivating these qualities could help with many of the difficulties that our world is facing by countering domination, competition, unilateral authority, and helping us relate to people around us as equals and not as enemies. I have to shout out to Sue Malik, who is in Cleveland celebrating her daughter's birthday. But she shared, I think seeing the sermon topic, she shared a video with me about a community of lesbians in Kansas City, Missouri in the 1980s and 90s, who formed a community, a deliberate urban community called Womantown. Their goal was to seek freedom from the discrimination that they experienced in many sectors of society, and specifically in housing. The women sold or rented property in a 12-block area with the goal, again, of providing affordable homes for women in a safe neighborhood. It was not to make the greatest return on their investment. The result was a neighborhood that was marked by friendship, support, cooperation. Their official gatherings usually involved potlucks. One of the residents described it as a way of improving a neighborhood without gentrifying it, and said these women weren't coming in and fixing up the houses so they could sell them for a lot of money. They were fixing them up so they could stay there and have a community. Womantown declined after a few years due to lack of resources, but some women still live in that neighborhood, and for many more, it remains an example of what a society run by women could look like. I once attended a panel of women where one of the panelists pointed out that it would be more natural for women to sit in a circle where everyone can contribute rather than to have some of them sitting up front as experts. So today's hymns are both about circles, which are symbols of equality and connection. The opening hymn replaced familiar words of the song "We Are Climbing Jacob's Ladder" with the image of dancing Sarah's circle, encouraging us to replace hierarchical thinking with a perspective that sees those around us as companions on the journey, as helpers, as friends. We'll close with a UU update of the old hymn, "Will the Circle Be Unbroken?" Yes, we sang it last week. We're going to do it again. The original Christian lyrics and the update are both written by women, and both of these women suggest the circle to represent human community. By acting out of friendship, trust, and equality, we can build a more peaceful world. A good step would be fully engaging women in the democratic process and at the highest levels of government. Perhaps women would have given diplomacy more of a chance before launching an attack on Iran, as the current hyper-masculine administration has done. All I'm going to say about that. The idea of a government, though, balanced by the gifts of men and women, has been around for a while. Our opening words were written 250 years ago as John Adams and the other male founders had the awesome responsibility of crafting a new democracy, rejecting the hierarchical authority of the monarch and creating a government of equals. John's wife Abigail wrote, imploring her husband and the others to remember the ladies and to not create a system where men could succumb to their tyrannical tendencies, but would allow women equality as friends and not subjects. Despite her plea, the equals that were written into our founding documents were other white landowning men. Women did not gain the right to vote for almost 150 years and still struggle for full participation in our government. 250 years after Abigail Adams' plea, we still need to remember the ladies, as well as trans, non-binary, gender fluid persons, and men who embody less tyrannical qualities that can help us all break out of patterns of domination and reach across differences to form circles of compassion and trust. May it be so. Amen. The choir is now going to offer an anthem by Carol Etzler, who coincidentally also wrote the words to Sarah's Circle, our opening hymn. The anthem recognizes the important role of women who have gone before us. So interspersed between the verses, we're going to name some of those women. After verses 1 and 2, you will hear readings from two women in our midst here, about two women from the early years of Meadville Unitarianism. I found it interesting that these women illustrate the gender roles of their time. Both of them remained unmarried, so they could devote time and resources to the church and the seminary that married women and mothers at that time could not as easily do. So even as we hear about these two women, we will recognize that throughout the history of our church, wives, mothers, spinsters, widows, divorcees, and all women have taught Sunday school and tended nursery. They have sewed for the poor and for soldiers in times of war. They organized bazaars that were apparently a highlight of the season for all of Meadville. They served and still serve as board members, committee leaders, and volunteers. So after the choir sings the third verse of the anthem, we will invite you to name aloud, to shout out the names of anyone who comes to your mind, male, female, or any other gender, but who has had a personal impact you or whose life has inspired you by exhibiting traits such as care, concern, and equality that we traditionally associate with women. Following the final verse of the anthem, then, we will have a period of silence where you can reflect on all of the names who have been raised up in our body today.
I am reading from Pew 11. A leader in the independent Congregational Church from its earliest days, Margaret Shippen moved to Meadville from Philadelphia in 1825. The same year, her brother Henry Shippen arrived in Meadville to serve as judge of the 6th Judicial District. The Shippens were a large, prominent Philadelphia family whose members included Margaret and Henry's cousin, Peggy Shippen, who married Benedict Arnold. In his History of Our Church, Earl Morse Wilbur describes Margaret as already a zealous Unitarian from Mr. Furness's church at Philadelphia, and so far as I have been able to learn, the only one of the first adherents of this church who had been trained in Unitarianism elsewhere. In 1830, Margaret bought three lots on the corner where our church now stands, which had been part of the original David Mead estate. She made her home in a brick house at the rear of the lot, on the site of the present Marquette Bank building. The house had been built by the county in 1819 and had served as county offices until the completion of the new courthouse in 1825. In 1831, Aunt Shippen, as she was affectionately called, organized the first Sunday school for the church, which was held in her home. When the congregation was ready to erect a church building in 1835, Margaret Shippen, jointly with Jan Heidekoper, gifted a portion of her property to the church trustees. As Wilbur wrote, the wise forethought of Miss Margaret Shippen had secured a favorable location for the church on the southeast corner of the public square. In 1864, she donated her house to the church for a parsonage. Most of the ministers did not live in the house, which was rented, then demolished in 1891 to make room for a new parsonage. In her memoirs, Emma Cullum Cortazzo recalls Auntie Shippen as having a remarkable intelligence, a strong mind, and excellent judgment. But she admits that it was Miss Shippen's eccentricities that most struck her child's mind. Margaret was known to layer several articles of clothing at once and to close her eyes for extended periods of time while speaking. This allowed Emma's mischievous cousins the opportunity to slip into her kitchen and locate the cookies without being detected. Aunt Shippen's dinner guests were also known to use periods when her eyes were closed to slip her strange and often inedible food into their laps, to be dumped in the yard for the chickens on their way out. Margaret Shippen returned to live in Philadelphia, most likely in the 1860s, when she deeded her house to the church, along with pew number 11, which she had purchased when the church was built, as churches raised money at that time by selling pews to the highest bidder. She died May 9, 1876, at age 94, along with Harm Jan Heidekoper and other church founders. Margaret Shippen is remembered for the financial gifts and spiritual commitment that laid the foundation of our congregation.
No dress rehearsal.
The Heidekoper family abounded in women who served their families, communities, and the Unitarian congregation by teaching Sunday school, volunteering, and engaging in their own literary and academic pursuits. Harm Jan Heidekoper's wife, Rebecca, Heidekoper's wife Rebecca was known to have had an independence streak. We see that independence in their two daughters, Anna, who married Unitarian clergyman James Freeman Clark, and younger daughter Elizabeth. The daughters were educated alongside their three brothers, and the 10 granddaughters likewise grew up to be women of letters, as well as travelers, artists, scientists, and philanthropists. Mary Ann Berger Woods shared a paper about the Heidekoper women as part of the Meadville 1825 celebration last year. According to the seating plan of 1845, the Heidekoper family owned this pew and several others along this side of the church. Elizabeth, the youngest child of Harm Jan and Rebecca, was indispensable to her father after Rebecca died and became a pillar of the community in the Meadville Theological School. Harm Jan wrote of Elizabeth to his other daughter, Anna, that he had only known her as a kind, affectionate daughter, as well as ever cheerful and ever happy Lizzie. But after her mother died, he came to know her as a firm, strong woman, possessing a power of self-control which I have never seen equaled. Single for life, Elizabeth devoted herself to the church and the seminary. Her brother Frederick had been educated at Harvard and served as the seminary's first professor. But Elizabeth joined her other brothers, Alfred and Edgar, to support the school. Concerned that the school's financial well-being, Elizabeth was the first woman to serve on its board of trustees and was president of the board from 1891 until her death in 1908. In that role, she largely guided the school after her brother Frederick's death. Her gifts to the seminary included real estate, furnishings, especially for the library, and financial support for many students, prompting historians of the school to write that she should have been called the mother of the theological school, for she had opened her home to the students and shared with the school a generous portion of her worldly goods. Also a strong supporter of the church, Elizabeth and Harm Jan Heidekoper's other heirs gave a gift in 1875 that allowed the congregation to build the parish house. When she died at the age of 90, her obituary noted, "Miss Heidekoper was a moving spirit in every good cause of Meadville. Her sympathy and charity knew no family or church limitation. It was as wide as humanity. For her to know there was want or suffering was to relieve it instantly and generously." Noting the universal sorrow that the city felt at her death, the obituary claimed, "Probably no resident of the city of Meadville was so well known throughout the land as she. The hundreds of graduates of the theological school living in every part of the world have carried with them and spread abroad knowledge of her beautiful character, exemplified in a most beautiful life."